Welcome to this bonus episode of Pulp Kitchen. This week we'll be talking about Loki Season 2 in spoiler detail, in spoiler glory. But before we do that, I just wanted to share my thoughts on the two films you talked about last week.
Yes.
Which was David Fincher's The Killer and How to Have Sex. Just because I've now gone and seen them this week.
Spoilers for both of those films, I
assume. Yeah, spoilers for both of those films. I think we also have an email to read about How to Have Sex as well. So, The Killer, which you reviewed last week, David Fincher's The Killer, which I've seen now, and I saw it on the big screen as well. I was able to do that instead of seeing it on Netflix. But as we know, it's out on Netflix now. James reviewed it. David Fincher's new film, Michael Fassbender, Hitman, Hit Goes Wrong. He needs to globetrot around the world. And you were very, very complimentary to the film's execution and the David Fincher style. Now, I would say that I basically broadly agree with you, but I think I enjoyed it just a little less than you. I think that absolutely the film's literal subtitle is Execution is Everything.
Yeah.
And that is true, but I also think that's the film's greatest strength and the film's greatest weakness, because absolutely this film is slick, stylish, well executed, interesting, and in the 2 hours in which you spend its company, you are I was having a perfectly like interested and engaged time. But it can't hide the fact that the story, the essential plot is just so generic, so familiar, which is fine. And I understand it's a dealing in a B-movie tropes. I'm not saying it needs to reinvent the wheel. But the ingredients we have seen, the beats of the narrative beats of the film we have seen before.
Yeah.
Hit Goes Wrong.
John Wick, kind of similar.
Having to go back in the... So, but because of that... I think the film really doesn't leave you with much else other than that style. So that's why I say when you're watching it, it's perfectly fine, perfectly slick. But when you get to the end of the film, I was kind of like, cool. And nothing really else stayed with me, because style isn't enough to stay with you. You need to get something deeper under your fingernails to really kind of hold you, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Okay. Fassbender, great, all that. And the narrativizing is great. And the style, like I said, that's fine and that is interesting. But also, what I think one reason that it doesn't stick with me quite as much as maybe other people, but I really just felt like a very safe film for Fincher to make.
Sure.
Felt like a very, very safe... Fincher can do this with his eyes closed, and that's fine, but I just felt there was no real risk. There was nothing new. What's it saying? Like with Gone Girl, that's an interesting one. That's a very Fincher film, but I like that because that's him sinking his teeth into an existing text that's very different to the one he's done before. And I know The Killer is an existing text, but it's very, very familiar story. It's fine. I think. You know, trying to launch your film off of the back of, you know, discovering that this girlfriend of his has been beaten up and stuff, done in very slick, stylish Fincher fashion. But I'm also like, I feel nothing really to propel me through.
You don't really know who she is to him in the beginning.
You assume. I get it. I'm not saying I need every. I'm absolutely. I like the fact that it's minimal and kind of very quick. And deliberate in its pace, absolutely. I just kind of felt sometimes that I was eating in like a very, very austere Scandinavian restaurant. And
hard edge, clean
line. And I was like, could someone just like turn the heating
dots
on?
Dots of like, sauce on the plate. Yeah.
The key is that the best moments of it is when it explodes. So the scene with the fight scene
kitchen.
He has in with the Floridian down in Florida.
Yeah.
I really like that because that's when the film really got messy and got chaotic and got its hands dirty.
Scenes with the dog.
A change of pace, yeah. And I liked that when it kind of changed its pace a little bit. But for the most part, it felt like a very clean, overly presented anorak laid out, you know, spotless.
Ironed on the bed.
Ironed. Yeah. Fine. But I absolutely think it's a mid-Fincher movie. It is a very safe choice for him. And I think it's fine.
Yeah.
But I think I would look forward to him doing something else. It's like I said last week, he's kind of gone from two extremes. He did Mank, which was so far removed from his usual oeuvre.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, okay, that's cool. But, you know, I don't know if how great a film that really was. And now he's come back the other way and he's played it completely safe with this. And I think, you know, I think a little bit more. It could have just done with a little bit more. But
so I think so much of what you said is right. And where I think I disagree with you is that, like, on paper, everything about it is vanilla, and you think about like someone trudging through trying to find out what's happening. And we like, I think we've heard say we both very much enjoy our time with it because it's so slick. But where it interests me is the fact that it's the film is inherently trying to understand a character who doesn't want to let you understand him. And that sort of like reverse process of you only really knowing a little bit about who that person is revealed till the very end. Like, I thought the conversation with Tilda Swinton was interesting. And that's sort of like, I don't know who this is and they don't want to be known, but I'm as an audience member left in the dark. And that kind of reverse part is, I think, what Finch is trying to do. I'm not saying it's the most successful thing ever, but while it's very slick and I'm like, oh, it's engaging and it's very enticing. That sense of like, you're trying to understand him, but he doesn't want you to understand him is where I think it's kind of a little bit more interesting.
I've seen some very interesting reviews.
But I do think the ending really sneaks. Did you find the ending sneaks up on you? That weird little quick epilogue?
No.
No, it did for me.
It just sort of like, ended and I was like, yep, that's it. <Is it? laughs> I have seen a few reviews that say that kind of they say that the best way to read this film is not as a hitman thriller. It's actually as a very, 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 very black comedy.
Okay.
And they say if you look at the very deliberate pacing and everything, it's a very, very deadpan comedy. And I think it's an interesting way of looking at it. And I kind of see what they're saying, that there's something sort of... Because I saw one review that was like, he's kind of bad at his job. But then I don't think he is bad at his job. He just something goes wrong.
Yeah.
But I kind of think there's a character... It's more like... There's a slight character study of a, you know, someone basically having a bit of a crisis, like a bit of like an internal crisis, but he happens to be a hitman. I think there are comedic...
There's no room to... He doesn't have room to express that while he has to kill.
I think that's where I think it's coming. There are deep sort of... I think there is like a very, very subtle comedic intention behind this film that if you watch it again, I think...
There's a couple of jokes in there.
Yeah, I think actually if you go back and watch it again, I think that might actually reveal more about the film if you look at it in that way.
Like, thank God for Postmates for letting the door through. It's all security until Postmates. It's a someone orders a burrito on Postmates.
And then all the aliases that he has are US sitcom comedy characters.
Oh, I didn't see
so
that.
So Felix...
Oh, is this true? Is this what the review said?
No, this is what I spotted.
Oh, right. Okay.
So it's on the plane ticket, but this ties in with that theme.
Right.
So on the plane ticket, it says Felix Unger and Oscar Madison. That's the characters in the odd couple. And then there's, I can't actually remember them. But I looked them up afterwards. And I was like, oh, that's the name of the lead character in All in the Family. And that's these American sitcom characters
in
there.
I didn't pick up on that.
No, but anyway, so I think if I saw that, I thought, really? Looking at it as a comedy, because it really doesn't present itself that way. But the more I thought about it, I was like, oh, actually, maybe that is in there. Maybe Finch is actually having a real sort of dark, wry smile on his face.
He's howling with laughter when he watches it.
Anyway, so that was that. And then I also saw How to Have Sex, which, by the way, I really had a bizarre screening experience with that, in which I saw it in a cinema screening room, which was absolutely freezing.
Like, oh no.
So cold. And I do think it kind of impacted my enjoyment of the film because I was sat there thinking, fuck, it looks warm where they are. My toes, I couldn't feel my toes.
Really?
Yeah.
In a multiplex? Or
yeah,
more
of a, yeah. And a shite one, I have to say. Yeah, the one I have to go to because it has 50. But I have two, there is a cinema brand that has two cinemas near me and I have a limitless, unlimited, monthly thing you have with it, right? Subscription. And one of them, cinemas, is really nice, but only has three screens. The other one is quite shit. Yeah. It's got 15 screens. So I often have to go to the 15, and they're equidistant from me, right?
I have a feeling that the cinema brand that you're referring to also has a multiplex near me that is the worst cinema multiplex I've ever been to. It's where I saw Blue Beetle. And it's near where I live. And it's I went there for the first time to see Blue Beetle, and I walked in and I was like, good Lord, I'll just get in and get out, watch film. And the seats were just terrible and probably negatively affected my impact. That were really kind of poor film. Anyway,
so How to Have Sex, which James talked about last week, which is about three friends going to Malia, that's right, Greek party island. They're quite young. They've just finished their GCSEs, which is younger than any people I knew.
Yeah, it's on the young end. I went at 17 and I think they were like 16.
Three girls.
Oh, like my main thing of watching that is way too young to be in nightclubs.
Yeah.
As like a grown up, I'm like, kids shouldn't go. Kids just shouldn't go. It should be an adult thing. Anyway.
Still them smoking and I was like, put that down.
Yeah.
Anyway, they go to this party island and you know, it's as you would imagine, it's crazy. It's neon clad. It's big and wild. And
hypersexualized as well.
Hypersexualized. Yeah, this very sexualized world. And what happens, we'll talk about this in spoiler territory like we said we did, is that in it, the main character, what's her name?
I know. Yeah, Tara.
Tara, is raped and twice actually in the film. And so splits this film from being sort of kind of naive, innocent walking into this kind of crazy carnival to them being a kind of a coming of age, crashing back down to earth, hellscape of a party island. Mm. And I thought it was really interesting. I think it was incredibly sensitive, really, really well pitched. And what I liked is that every time they woke up in the film and it was the next morning, you know, like you basically followed the characters throughout the entire day.
Yeah.
And they woke up the next morning. It was like they descended to another level of hell.
Right.
And things
yeah,
just
sure.
got worse and worse and worse. And the kind of that in the first half, that like palpable sense of like dangerous sexual energy is just really uncomfortable.
I really got a sense of like sex being like really put onto this otherwise non-sexual friendship, but they yes. have like they're friends and they don't. I of course like people talk about sex, but I feel like this over-sexualized yeah. environment had like turned everything up. Mm. And that's what I thought was really interesting about like the yeah. hyper-sexualization of those party islands. I sound so like grown up, but I was like, oh, that's I've not really thought yeah. about that before.
And even the swimming pool, it's like this kind of phallic
shape. Yeah, shaped like a dick. Yeah,
like. And
which I'm sure they are in those hotels. Yeah,
and I thought that was really interesting, and the way it portrays like kind of discomfort and trauma, yeah, and just how this what a place that can be at one point just like kind of a curious carnival,
yeah.
can the next minute be absolutely hell on earth. So absolutely worth the watch. I have nothing really bad to say about it other than I just think you probably got more out of it than me. I was like, yep, that was yeah. in a way it's kind of similar to The Killer in that it is a very narratively very simple, but it is very well executed. But unlike The Killer, I think that How to Have Sex actually has something to say.
Yeah.
About something quite important.
To me, the first like half or even two thirds of How to Have Sex, I was like, yeah, enjoying, get it. Can see where this is likely to go. Interesting dynamics, like unsaid dynamics between the girls and the boys and like the jealousy between it's Sky and Tara and like the possessed, like sort of like flip between two guys at one point. And then like what, for me, where the film really got me is in that last 20, 25 minutes, specifically the last scene when
at the airport,
when, you know, Tara is really trying to, frankly, like not explain what's happened. And as an audience member, we've seen it and we understand it. And it's a tale, unfortunately, as old as time. And what I think is so great about that moment and quite a damning indictment on our society and how we don't understand these things, that those characters really lack the vocabulary to explain to each other what's happened, yet they understand each other. Mm. It's like they have like either a shared experience or a shared understanding of sexual dynamics, but there's no words they use to explain that. Like
particularly when you're young as well.
Particularly when you're young. Like, you know, I don't know about you, I wasn't really taught about consent when sex ed. It was
we
like
weren't.
If maybe a passing thing of like a very well understood, like this is not, you know, you don't do that when you have sex. And it's like you, like this idea of being taught how to have sex. There's like the biological element and then like what it means and how you do it. And I always think it's really hard when a film is going to portray rape as complicatedly as it does in this film, and the circumstances at which it occurs, and which like a half yes on one occasion, which is still a little bit
which
off.
But kind of it's pressurized.
Pressurized, even though it's technically that she does. They do make a point to show that she does consent the first time, and then the second time that being.
But then also the question is like, it's like, yes, it's consent, but like really she's in a situation where she's been overpowered.
Totally. And like under pressure to do something on a holiday. It's like, well, if you said yes once, do you then mean, is it an implied yes again?
Yes. And the film kind of lays...
I think that's really hard to get to do right.
Also, the film is kind of laying the groundwork to say that these acts of sexual violence don't come out of a vacuum. They are... The kind of the tinderbox for it is kind of laid out, the fuel for it is laid out, and... by over-sexualized culture that doesn't really that kind of disregards the kind of rights.
People
of
aren't really ready to like have this kind of interactions.
It's like the whole setting up of that environment is like, this is if you have this kind of environment with these kind of people and this kind of activity, this is what happens.
But then that moment in the duty free, trying to understand why she's there, and it's all shot through the
split mirror.
The mirrors just at the eyes.
And she's also the way...
And nothing can be said, and I'm like, I totally feel it. And the lack of words is more powerful than saying it at that point.
And the way she dresses after the fact is like, you know, she goes from wearing you know, like neon bikini to wearing very beige, plain colored, covered up clothes. Just, you know, this kind of a depersonalization.
Yeah.
Mm. Anyway, very good.
Just before we move on to Loki, Khadija, friend of the show.
Khadija? I'd say Khadija.
I apologize. Says, hi, George and James. Hope you guys are doing well. I have never clicked on an episode faster than last week's where you guys discussed Molly Manning Walker's debut, How to Have Sex. I was lucky enough to catch it at the North American premiere at TIFF. I was initially attracted to the film because the lead actress,
International Film Festival,
Mia Bruce, was in Tracy Beaker's Dumping Grounds, and me and my sister loved that show growing up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But this film completely took me by surprise. Can I just say, Khadija, you don't like capital letters at all. You're like a new brand that just won't use capital letters. It's all like lo-fi coffee.
They're capitalist, man.
Throwing me, but you do you. I was enraptured from start to finish and have not stopped thinking about it since September. I agree with what James said about Walker having complete understanding of tonal range. It was funny and outrageous when it needed to be and uncomfortable and quiet when it calls for it. It was so interesting to watch something as disturbing and traumatic as sexual assault fly under the radar for Tara's friends, which only goes to show how that happens more often than we'd think. Bruce's performance was spectacular. Truly one of my favorites of 2023. Yeah, that contrast between their energy when they first turn up, like loud, let me speak to the hotel receptionist, and like obviously afterwards.
Also, the other friend, the blonde friend, has a problematic relationship with sex.
Yes, guy, like, also like putting it on herself to be the one who's had the most sex, and therefore like adopting that identity even further.
But measures and her entire value system is based on sex.
Guys, last night was a failure because no one had sex.
Did you have sex? We've got to get back and shag the local men now.
Totally.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. Thank you, Khadija.
That was last week's stuff. Sorry, guys. That was a little recap on the films from last week. And now we shall talk about Loki season two.
Season two.
Can you do the
I love the music.
Me too. What about when the letters appear?
Every time the music... every time the music came, I was really hyped.
So, we actually spoke about Loki very briefly, I think, in like the first ever episode when we did this show, which was 2 years ago. We just talked about like how we liked it. And I must say, when I started season two, I was like, oh my God, where am I with this again?
God,
100%. What happened? The TV. Renslayer. What did she do again?
And the He Who Remains scene. Yeah. I actually rewatched that, I want to say a month before, because I was like, what was said in that? And there was like the little metallic balls that like show the different versions of him. And I think coming out of Quantumania, one of my comments was like, I still don't understand how Kang works. Mm. But anyway.
So Loki was back. As we know, this is going to be a spoiler-filled discussion.
Yeah, spoilers for Loki season two.
So after He Who Remains, back at the TVA, lots of hijinks. And six episodes, which I think is a nice, actually, relief compared to not just Marvel, but like most TV content. Six episodes
is nice.
A hot six. You know, on the whole, James, what do you think?
I enjoyed it. I had the same, just commenting on, like, I started it and I was like, oh my God, there's a lot of words. There's a lot of timelines, variants, different versions. And to be honest, throughout the whole thing, I am just about keeping up.
Yeah.
But all in all, I had a really fun time in that show, which our season one comments of it being a really like solid, high budget Doctor Who still stands.
Yeah.
So much of that like zipping through time and zipping through different moments is all really, I really enjoy it.
Yeah, me too.
I think Tom Hiddleston really goes for it in this, and I feel like all of his gang are all like having a good time and really enjoying themselves with it. I mentioned this in my review in the episode of Captain Marvel, but I think like just visually, Loki has such a wonderfully intentional and distinct visual palette that's just a joy to watch. Everything is shot really interestingly. The color palette is distinct and I enjoy it. My main thing is that like I don't always know where I am and like the time slipping is still, I'm really concentrating and I am like, okay, that version of this character and that version there, and that's not Kang, it's what's his name again, something Timely. Victor Timely.
Kang technically is not in this movie. In the series,
he is. That's the He Who Remains.
He's not called Kang, though.
This is the thing. It's like,
Kang's just a version of Quantumania.
And then I think like the way in which that the whole thing ends with Loki essentially like stripping himself of the TVA uniform, reclaiming his identity as Loki, but like completely reformed from who he was. Mm. He used to be the god who like longed for the throne more than anything else and would do anything to like get anyone else out of the way, but this time making the ultimate sacrifice for his friends, which he's never really had before, like to let them live a normal life so he can essentially be like the god of time. I thought a really
to
great
sit on
the
throne
to sit on a different throne.
That is his punishment.
Totally. And I thought that, you know, there's quite an interesting thing where both the finale and the first episode are called Glorious Purpose. And his line was, I am Loki and I am burdened with glorious purpose. And I quite like the sort of re-returning of his character. And I think Loki stands as one of the most interesting characters in the MCU. If you think about where Loki starts, it's a fairly one-dimensional, but I think he has dimensions in Thor, but in the Avengers he's kind of there to serve a purpose. And obviously, like, we get a different version of Loki that's gone beyond Avengers 1, but like where we see Loki go to is so interesting. And it's he's graduated from villain in my eyes, and he's a character that's like one of the best well thought out, well evolved characters in the MCU. So overall, I really enjoyed it.
The last time we'll see him?
No, I think he'll be back.
You think he'll do a third series?
No, they're not going to do a third series, but he will be... Because he's got these abilities to, like, shift through time.
But surely he has to sit there to hold on to the time strands.
He's holding on to the thing. Yeah, I got a sense he sort of created some order.
Sure. In the time tree.
Yes. I picked up, I don't know how much you know about Norse mythology. Did you get the whole Yggdrasil thing?
No, only when reading about it afterwards.
I just want to preface this. I'm not smart. I've just played God of War, okay? Which is set in Norse mythology. So I noticed this. I was like, oh, Loki is building Yggdrasil, which in Norse mythology is the tree that connects all of the realms of Asgard, Midgard, Svartalheim, Niflheim, like all of the realms essentially are bound by the tree, okay? And he essentially like brings that together. And I thought, oh, that's Yggdrasil. And then I Googled it and people were like, oh yeah, totally Yggdrasil from Norse. And like in Norse mythology, there's this sense that this is now I've got from further reading, just to clarify. In Norse mythology, to achieve something great, you have to sacrifice something a lot. And Odin sacrifices his eye to the well at Yggdrasil in order to be able to see across all the realms. And there's this interesting thing where like Loki, you know, Thor made his sacrifice of his throne and his ego to become Thor. He's almost like gotten rid of his selfishness and his old identity to essentially save time and stitch it together. Oh, nice little Norse thing. Loki's not just like a random agent. He is still like that Norse god. I thought like he takes on the Loki garments as well and like rids himself of the old identity. I thought, great, nice little Norse bit there.
And nod. As a character arc, works fantastic.
Totally, yeah.
I think I basically said everything. I totally agree. I like the zipping around. I like all the people in it. I liked Kiki Kwan, who I thought would be in it for one episode, but it's actually the entire series.
Really important role.
So fun to watch.
Yeah. Get dialed up to 10 and not in a cheesy way. He like really means everything he says and communicates really complicated science, which is like, no, but we have to do this to do that.
They clearly saw Everything Everywhere All at Once. And they were like, can you do lots of exposition dumps again?
Yes.
In a science fiction movie.
Because there's quite a lot of like, they need to explain that the rings need to be bigger. And they do quite a good job of like showing you visually as much as they can. And he does a really good job of like, oh, this physics thing. Great.
I also think that... just on Jonathan Majors, stuff outside of the film in his life aside, as Victor Timely, the only week, the episode I thought was the weakest was the one in 1863.
Okay.
And when he first appeared as Victor Timely doing everything, after one, I was like,
can we stop
you're
the
annoying me. Yeah, not just the stutter, but the way you are talking is
a little
just,
bit.
It doesn't
overacted.
Sound. Yes, it's a prototype. I'm like, but why are you? You're not old. You're not an old man. You are like 35, maybe.
Really sharp scientist.
After a while, I was like, you're overperforming this. But what I liked is that when it cut to him as he who remains, completely different interpretation of the character. Yeah. It's fine. But also when he was doing the timely thing, it reminded me of how he spoke in Quantumania, which I found really annoying. When he was like, Scott, you know, do the thing, bit theatre kid.
Time to die.
Yeah, basically, Dr. Evil. But I think actually Timely as a character kind of grew on me. I like the whole kind of, the whole Sylvie arc was kind of resolved in a way. It didn't carry over this like conflict of being another version of Loki. It was kind of folded back into the story, I thought, quite nicely. And
repeating sense of place for a lot of characters, like Mobius's Mobius's home, his real home, the McDonald's that Sylvie now works in, Kiki Kwan's like lab that gets more and more developed as he understands physics more and more, and you keep going to those same places and they all sort of change in different ways. I thought that was quite cool.
I don't know whether this was how I felt about Renslayer as a character or about their use of Renslayer as a character as a plot device, but every time she turned up I would go, oh, fuck off. Yeah. So, like, can you just stop holding the plot up? There's serious shit to deal with in the time loop. Can you stop turning up and like, oh, go away. You and Miss Minutes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was thinking in terms of the Marvel thing as a whole, why Loki works is, first of all, it's in a pocket outside of the... It belongs in a pocket of existence outside of the rest of the...
Very removed, literally. Yeah.
So it has a bit like how... Well, the first two Marvel shows we got were... Well, the first couple, it was like WandaVision and Loki, and they have something in common, which is creating a bubble in which you
literally
a bubble in which you can create your own show without having to deal with the necessary... Obviously, by the end of WandaVision, that changes.
Make your own little...
But in Loki... It's like, we can actually do stuff over here. And I was like, oh, I'm actually relieved.
Mm.
But the irony is that it does it so well. You're like, I wish you could bring this interest and this intrigue back into the rest of the MCU, because I'm watching this thinking, oh, if it was all as good as this, I would be really
interested. Feels relevant and sharp and switched on. It's like, no, pay attention. This matters. And you're going to learn about Kang. It's still kind of confusing, but...
Loki made the multiverse interesting again.
Totally.
I was really into it. I was like, yeah, you're the sacred timeline and the other branches. How you got to protect them? Oh my God, the different versions of Kang. What are you going to do? That's great. I did not get that at all from any other Marvel movie that we've seen.
A lot of them, and that's why I've given up on a lot of them, they just seem very like irrelevant and disposable.
Yeah.
Do I need to watch this? It turns out, no.
Yeah.
So I'm yet to be caught out by one.
I like also, because also when they said they were going to make a second season of Loki, I was kind of like, oh, but I liked the first one so much. They got away with it. I had very low expectations. They got away with it. I didn't think they were going to do another one. And now they've done it. I'm like, good. I think we've left that in a place now where that's quite comfortably left. I hope the rest of the movies can do something sensible with that kind of intelligence that this show was made with. But
basically, I think to do this time hopping multiverse stuff, you can't half-ass it. You have to really go for it, which Loki really commits to.
Yeah.
To the point where I'm like 5-6 episodes in. You know, in the 6th episode, like the fun part is he realizes he can travel through time and reset things. I'm like, yes, like I'm with you because this is all about time travel.
Yes.
And my previous comments about like that multiverse having a negative effect on the MCU is that actually, just to have it as one part of your plot to bring back whoever you want kind of breaks the structure of everything else. Mm. Unless your entire structure is time travel and dimensions, then you can run with it.
Yeah.
But I there's a great moment when he's like doing the sort of Edge of Tomorrow source code thing where he's like redoing it over and over again. Yeah. And he's like, how long would it take to teach me all of physics? Yeah. And he's like, all of physics?
Yeah.
Probably centuries. And then you just see cut centuries later. That great moment that he's just spent centuries learning everything about physics.
Get on the gangway, put a thing, push the green button, don't put it down, run back.
And he's really good, Tom Hiddleston. Yeah. He does that. I mean, he's got the Doctor Who sort of uniform with his little pop collar and the tie.
You know what? He would make a great Doctor.
He would make a fantastic Doctor.
Oh my God, they would be
Wouldn't he be great?
They could not afford him.
No, they can't afford him, and he's already doing...
And he's already doing Loki.
He's just done it.
He's just done
it. But I watched this, I was like, holy shit, like the being in like a lab with knobs and controls and being really frantic is like so Doctor Who.
Yeah.
The time, and the thing happening outside the glass.
Oh, he would
be so good. Very Star Trek, like the bridge.
Mm.
You also have a CG thing.
Like, I had this kind of like, I mean, literal, some the TVA is very dark and like moody, but like I like the kind of dark... There was like this kind of existential darkness to the whole thing of being like, no, all people will be wiped out.
Yeah.
There's a real sense of death. When Timely runs out and gets turned into time spaghetti.
Yeah.
I quite like that. I was like, oh, it's a bit of a shock. You know, I was like, oh yeah, that's kind of
really
freaking
cool
up.
Visuals when Sylvie's in the record shop and the camera like goes above her. Mm. Just every time, shot interestingly, cool angles, great blocking.
Yeah.
A really cool aesthetic.
It was great. I'm glad we both liked it. For a show that I didn't know if I was going to dip into, I put on for a bit of fun.
Watched one, classic me, and then waited for other people to be like, oh no, it's really good. And then when like people saw the finale, I was like, okay, I'll binge it.
That was Loki season 2. If you have any thoughts, let us know by emailing into hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
Do you think that Loki has like damned himself to an eternity on like that throne of time?
Yeah, that's his...
He'll be there.
It's
now
kind of a very kind of mythological ending to be like, he's discovered his purpose.
Yeah.
But that is also a great burden. There's always an inherent sacrifice. With great power comes a great burden.
Mm.
And he's like, he's got what
glorious
he's always
purpose.
Wanted. Exactly. He's got his glorious purpose has been a great burden.
It's quite a nice book closer, isn't it?
That's a nice chapter. I would be happy if they never returned to him.
And Mobius just gets to hang out with his kids.
He just
plays Owen Wilson.
Is he going to go back?
I'm gonna do it.
I don't get it. Is he waiting for Loki to turn up so he can slot back into his life, or is he just like...
Oh, good point.
Is he just watching?
I think he knows that he can come in.
I thought he was gonna watch his kids for a bit, then go back to the TVA.
I wonder if he's changed forever.
Is Renslayer gonna get eaten by the big monster at the end of time, or is she seeing something else? Because I was hoping she'd get eaten.
All right.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? It'll be interesting to see. Because I think the TVA will be a part of Avengers Secret Wars or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Because TVA still remains. And it's like, they're there doing stuff. Yeah, I won't be surprised if you see the TVA again.
Mm. Anyway, Loki.
Party.
My God, the
keys. I know your brother.
You're going to do it.
I love it.
That's okay.
The wind in your hair.
You can't do it loud.
You have to.